Hello and welcome to Under New Management, the podcast that examines new and notable management research and how this research can enhance your effectiveness as a leader in your organization. I'm Mike Johnson, an assistant professor in the Foster School of Business at the University of Washington in Seattle. In this episode, I talk with Joel Brockner, the Philip Hettleman Professor of Business and Chair of the Management Division at the Columbia Business School at Columbia University. We talk about a stream of research Joel has pursued over 20 years, examining the concept of procedural fairness. Joel Brockner, welcome to Under New Management.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Good. Well, Joel, you've done a lot of research on procedural fairness. Can you talk about that concept?
Sure. Procedural fairness, it refers to how people go about planning decisions, you know, how people go about implementing decisions, the operative word being how. The early work on fairness in the workplace looked at what would be called outcome fairness, or sometimes called distributive justice. And there people were concerned with, you know, the fairness of the decisions themselves. So was it the case that the person who contributed the most was the most rewarded, you know, was an example of outcome fairness. And what we learned is that employees' reactions to decisions, you know, their willingness to support the decision, to support the decision maker, to support the organization as a whole, their motivation and so forth, was affected not only by the fairness of the outcomes, but also by the fairness of the process. And we now know that procedural fairness itself is a very complex or at least multifaceted topic or concept. So when procedural fairness was first introduced, it was actually equated with voice or input. You know, so decisions were seen as fair to the extent that people were allowed to either provide input into the decision, how the decision was going to be reached, or if they had input into the ultimate vote or the ultimate outcome, you know, of the decision. So voice was originally equated with procedural fairness or procedural justice. Sometimes those terms are used interchangeably, as I will. But we now know that many other factors drive people's perceptions of fairness of the process as well.
And so the difference between distributive justice and procedural justice, with distributive, it relates to the outcomes people receive. With procedural, it relates to kind of the process by which the decision was made.
Exactly. That's the key. So lots of things then go into the fairness of the process by which decisions were made. So as mentioned, it's not simply whether you had input, although that's a major determinant to whether you feel the process was fair. But it also depends upon a host of criteria identified by Gerald Leventhal back in the 1980s, things like whether the decisions were made consistently, whether decisions were made on the basis of accurate information. You know, for example, if you're going to decide who stays and who leaves during an organizational downsizing, and you're going to do it on the basis of merit, it has to be clear that the measure of merit is a valid or an accurate one. If people have a chance to appeal a decision, what's called correctability, you know, is another element of procedural fairness. Yet another one is whether people feel like the decisions were made with advance notice. If an important change was made in the workplace, was it made kind of overnight, or did people get training and a heads up that this important change would be coming down the pike? So there's lots of things that go into it, apart from whether people had voice. I should also mention that there's an interpersonal component of procedural fairness, sometimes called interactional justice. But the basic idea here is, you know, at the end of the day, decisions are planned and implemented by people, and how the recipient of the decision feels that the implementer did things. So did the implementer express concern? Did the implementer show signs of treating the person with dignity and respect, compassion? Did the implementer provide a explanation, or what Bob Bees would call a social account, you know, for the decision? All these factors have a huge bearing on whether people feel the process was fair, and whether people feel the process was fair in turn has a huge bearing on things that managers and organizations care about: motivation, productivity, commitment, morale, trust, and the like.
Well, this certainly seems like an interesting topic, and clearly has some organizational implications. How did you become interested in studying it, though?
Well, there's a few kind of war stories. One is my initial foray into the study of justice was in looking at job layoffs and their effects on the people who remain. There had been a lot of research on the kind of the human consequences of downsizing as they affected the people who lost their jobs. You know, what's the psychology of becoming unemployed, for example. But what was interesting was that very few people have been looking at the effects of layoffs on the people who remain behind in an organization. I say that's interesting because at the end of the day, it's the people who remain, who are sometimes called the survivors of an organizational downsizing. It's survivors' reactions, their productivity, their commitment, their morale, their trust. That's what's going to make or break whether the layoff is a successful one, whether it, you know, moves the organization to a place closer to where it wanted to be. So that was being overlooked in, you know, in both the practical writing as well as the theoretical writing on organizational downsizing. And to go one step further on how I got interested in the procedural justice topic, you know, what I was learning when talking to managers who had survived layoffs, who had played some role perhaps in the implementation of layoffs, I'd ask them, how were people taking it? How were the survivors responding? And in general, it was not a positive story in general, but what was even more striking was that there was a high degree of variance in survivors' reactions, both within organizations as well as across organizations. And that, you know, struck me as interesting. You know, why would the same event be responded to in such different ways? So that started a long program of research, continues to this day, on the factors that influence survivors' productivity, morale, commitment, and so forth. And very much integral to that is this notion of procedural fairness. What we found, and I and others have found, that the more that the survivors of a layoff feel that the layoff was handled fairly in the ways that I described, advance notice and explanation and treating people with dignity and respect and being sure that the decision criteria for keeping certain people and laying off others were fair, unbiased, transparent, accurate, and so forth, those factors had a major influence on the productivity and morale of the people who remained.
And you mentioned that this started off a long stream of research, and in fact, it's 20-plus years of research. Can you tell us about a little bit about how you went about studying procedural fairness?
Sure. It's been a long journey, as you said, and it's been a what I would call a multi-method approach. So in some instances, we've actually done, you know, laboratory experiments where we put people in a simulated layoff environment. We actually stage a layoff. I mean, the true participants don't know the whole event was being staged. So, you know, kind of like the old TV show Candid Camera, where you put people into a situation and measure their reactions. That's kind of like what we were doing, you know, in the laboratory studies. We'd stage a layoff, and then we would look at the reactions of the people who remained. And the person who was laid off was typically a Confederate, somebody who was working with us helping to stage the layoff, although the true participant didn't know that. And this enabled us to look, under very controlled conditions, at various factors that might affect the productivity and the commitment of the research participant. But as you know, laboratory findings, as important as they are and as useful they are for establishing causality, they oftentimes lack what we in the research biz call external validity or generalizability. Simply put, the question of how do you know that this really happens in the real world? So we've been doing field studies, in particular field surveys, going into organizations that have gone through layoffs and look at the people who remain, see how they are reacting. And again, what we find consistent with the anecdotal evidence that I alluded to earlier, that their reactions are quite variable, and then looking to see what the factors are that are driving that variability. And again, winnowing in on the notion of justice and procedural justice in particular. And by now we have, you know, pretty good evidence that survivors' reactions in both laboratory and field settings are greatly shaped by their perceptions of whether the process was done fairly.
Okay, so that relates to layoffs, but some of your research has dealt with the effects of procedural fairness related to other organizational actions as well?
Absolutely. And that's kind of what's exciting about the justice research is that there are basic principles that seem to cut across a wide variety of situations. So some of them are what I would call large-scale organization events, like layoffs, but they could include other significant changes in organizations like relocations or the introduction of new technology or some type of restructuring or even a merger and acquisition. So some type of large-scale organizational change. But procedural justice also matters in what I would call individually targeted events. So, for example, you and your manager are sitting down, and your manager is going to give you a performance appraisal. It's just you and your manager, nobody else in the room. Or you could talk about a negotiation you have with one other person, just you and that other person, nobody else in the room. Turns out that procedural fairness shapes people's reactions, again, their willingness to support the other person, to support the decisions reached by the other person, to support the organization or the context in which the whole transaction is taking place. All of those, what I would call system-oriented, externally focused types of reactions, depend upon procedural fairness. But there's more, and here's kind of the interesting, one of the most interesting findings we've discovered in these various situations, layoffs and otherwise. We not only look, Mike, at the fairness of the process in these studies, but we typically look at the fairness or the favorability of the outcome.
The distributive justice.
The distributive justice, and the first cousin of distributive justice is what I would call outcome favorability.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent do you feel that you are better off or worse off as a result of the decision? That tends to be highly correlated with whether you feel the outcome is fair or unfair, as you might expect. Yeah, the more favorable the outcome, the more fair we tend to think it is.
Sure.
So there's a high correlation, although there's a conceptual distinction between outcome fairness or outcome favorability. But that distinction is actually of lesser importance for this conversation. What we're finding is much more what the outcome factors, fairness or favorability, have in common with each other. And what they have in common with each other is that they both interact with the fairness of the process in a very interesting way. And here's the essence of it, that as long as people feel the procedure was done fairly, then they are going to be less affected by the fairness or the favorability of the outcome. Or said differently, it's when people feel the process was not done fairly, that's when their reactions are going to be very dependent upon whether they think they're better off or worse off as a result of the decision. Now, that's a point that what we call the interaction between procedural fairness and outcome fairness, that interaction is of theoretical interest, but it is also of great applied interest. I often tell managers, various executive audiences that I work with, I often tell them about this interaction between procedure and outcome. And rather than them seeing it as kind of like an academic finding, I'm speaking in highfalutin terms, interaction effects, they actually get it. They see the practical relevance because basically what I'm communicating to them is as long as they can do the process fairly, explain why, give advance notice, treat people with dignity and respect, involve people in decision-making. As long as you can do those procedural fairness things well, then you don't have to pay as much attention to whether people feel they're going to be better off or worse off as a result of a decision. Now, think about that. From a manager's point of view, they have much more control over the fairness of the process across the masses than they do have control over the favorability of the outcomes across the masses. I think the reality of organizational life is that in most situations, some people are going to be better off and some people are going to be worse off as a result of a decision. I mean, you try to do the best you can. You try to make those decisions that will make as many people better off as possible. But again, the reality is we're constrained from a resource point of view. You can't give everybody what they want. But what you can do is at least do the process in a fair or high quality way. I'll give you an example in terms of how the favorability or the fairness of the outcomes are more constrained than would be the case for the fairness of the process. And it's a baseball example, my one of my favorite sports.
Mine too.
You often hear, you too?
Yeah, absolutely.
procedural fairness is all around us, even when we're, seemingly watching TV late at night and minding our own business. you often hear a baseball player say that as long as the umpire is consistent in how he or she calls the game, then they can pretty much live with any decision. So the pitch is going to be either a ball or a strike. It can't be both. The runner is going to be safe or out. Can't be both. So some got to win, some got to lose. But what you can do is ensure that the process, in this case, the consistency with which you make the call, is done as fairly as possible. So you control the process across the masses much more than you can control the outcomes.
Well, that's a great example from baseball. Could you give us maybe one or two more examples from business, how managers can apply this?
Sure. Think of, again, what I would call a more individually targeted event, a manager giving one of their direct reports a performance appraisal, and in particular a pay raise associated with that performance appraisal. You can't give great raises to everybody. You just don't have the money. So how can you ensure that the recipient of that appraisal is going to be at least willing to be committed to you, maybe not head over heels, but they're at least somewhat committed to you. And the way you can do that is by ensuring fair process. So it would mean explaining why you made the decision, showing how the criteria were fair and unbiased and transparent, giving people a chance to respond or ask questions in return, allowing them to perhaps, you know, participate in the discussion or even in their appraisal. You know, so here's what we think. What do you think? We're going to take your point of view into account. We're not necessarily going to do anything that you say, but we will seriously consider what your suggestion is. So that would be one example on a more individually targeted basis. Another more, what I would call, large-scale organizational event basis would be a downsizing, you know, where what you can do as a manager is ensure that everybody gets a reasonable amount of severance or outplacement counseling, you know, or the package, as it's sometimes called. But you don't need to go overboard. You can be moderately generous in terms of the package, provided that you pay attention to the other procedural fairness elements of expressing concern and giving people advance notice and explaining why you're doing what you're doing. And those things you can control, and to the extent that you can and do the process well and fairly, then you don't need to go overboard in providing a ton of money in the context of a severance package or assistance in helping people get reemployed. Now, I'm not saying that you are procedurally fair, or managers or organizations can be procedurally fair and not worry about outcomes. Of course, you have to care about the outcomes. But once you reach a point of being moderately favorable in terms of giving people outcomes, then where you really want to invest your energy is in high procedural fairness. Because how people respond when they get a moderately favorable outcome with a fair process compared to how they respond when they get a very favorable outcome with a fair process, that difference is oftentimes very small, sometimes not even present at all. And yet, think about it. It costs you, and it costs organizations, a lot more money to be very generous or to give very positive outcomes from a bottom-line point of view relative to only giving moderately favorable outcomes. So there's a kind of a cost-effectiveness story here as well.
Well, it certainly sounds like there are a lot of organizational implications here. Can you, though, give us the bottom line for managers?
Well, you know, the bottom line is, as you say, the bottom line. I mean, procedural fairness is a good deal. It's also, by the way, a moral or an ethical imperative. I mean, I think you want to be procedurally fair, not simply because it's a good deal financially, although it is that, and I'll give an example in a moment, but it's kind of like the right thing to do. You'll feel better about yourself from a moral point of view if you are fair in how you go about planning and how you go about implementing decisions. But here's a more tactical bottom line reason to be procedurally fair. One study shows, actually my friend and colleague Alan Lind and Jerry Greenberg did a study a number of years ago, you know, which showed that one of the best predictors of whether somebody is going to sue for wrongful termination — these are the people who lose their jobs, I'm now focusing on them rather than the people who remain — but the best predictor of whether somebody's going to sue when they are laid off is how they feel they were treated by the manager who delivered the news to them. And it's along these procedural fairness elements, so especially the interactional justice component. So expressing concern, sympathy, showing compassion, giving advance notice, explaining why you're doing what you're doing. Those elements are very strong predictors of whether somebody's going to sue you or not. And here's how strong those procedural fairness elements matter. Think about a 5-point scale of rating a manager in their delivery of this bad news to a person that they're going to lose their jobs. Think of a 5-point scale whereby 5 means the person feels that the process was done very fairly, and 1 means they feel the process was done very unfairly. What Greenberg and Lind found is that if people felt the process was done as a 5, in other words, very fairly, 1 out of 100 people sued for wrongful termination. In other words, not very many, 1 out of 100, 1%. On the other hand, if people felt that the process was done very unfairly, they gave it a 1, then 1 out of 6 people, or 17 people out of 100, sued for wrongful termination. Now, let's do a little bit of, you know, further calculation to show how procedural fairness is a good deal, how it really does relate to the bottom line. What organizations need to consider is how much it's going to cost them to defend themselves in a wrongful termination lawsuit, and that's oftentimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, versus what are the costs of being procedurally fair? You know, the old expression, the ounce of prevention being worth the pound of cure. What does it cost to an organization or to a manager to come out doing it on a, as a five rather than as a one? I don't know, Mike. I don't know the specific answer to that question, but I got to believe it's a lot less than thousands of dollars, you know, from the manager's point of view or from the organization's point of view.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting phenomenon. The procedural fairness doesn't cost a lot of money usually, right? It produces good bottom line results.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good deal economically as well as morally and ethically, which then raises the question, you know, how come it's not practiced more often?
Yeah, absolutely. So why isn't it practiced more often?
Ah, thought you'd never ask. I think there's a, and here again, there's no one answer, but there's a bunch of them. Sometimes it's a matter of lack of knowledge. In other words, sometimes managers literally don't know that it's such a good deal to be procedurally fair. And if only they had realized, they would have made it more of a priority to be procedurally fair in planning and implementing decisions. Sometimes I think it's kind of a lack of skill. In other words, managers might think they're more procedurally fair than they really are. Yeah, you know, they might know about the concept of procedural fairness, know that it's a good deal, but they have an awareness gap, or in this case, I would say a self-awareness gap, a knowledge gap, rather. It's a self-knowledge gap. They think they're doing it more than they really are, and as a result, the benefits of being procedurally fair don't get realized. But there's, you know, that sounds kind of gloomy, but there's hope. There's recent and very promising research which shows that you can actually train managers in procedural fairness, and they can get better at it. And what the studies are showing, again, very convincingly and very optimistically, is that their employees whose managers undergo process fairness, procedural fairness training, actually respond a lot better. They're a lot less stressed. They're much more committed, much more productive, you know, relative to those employees whose managers have not undergone procedural fairness training. So it's kind of a good news, bad news element to that finding. You know, the good news is that managers can get better. The bad news is that they have so much room to move up. You know, it suggests that they're not doing, you know, procedural fairness nearly as much as they should be, because there's room for them to be trained and therefore get much better at it.
So we've been talking with Joel Brockner, a professor of business at Columbia University. Joel, thanks for talking with us today, and thanks for this great stream of research.
My pleasure to speak with you and the group, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading Under New Management, a podcast of the Organizational Behavior Division of the Academy of Management. The OB division has over 5,000 members dedicated to the science and practice of organizational behavior. For more information about the OB division, visit www.obweb.org. For more information about the Academy of Management and its over 17,000 members worldwide, visit www.aomonline.org. Computer support for this podcast is provided by Vu Tran.